Welcome to Books and Beyond with your hosts, Karen and Louisa. Join us for half an hour of information, entertainment, reading recommendations, and beyond. Brought to you by Auckland Libraries.
I know this girl, and she works in a library, yeah.
Kia ora from Karen, listeners. Today on Books and Beyond, we're celebrating Pride with a special guest, my friend and colleague at Auckland Libraries, Alison Fitzpatrick. Kia ora, Alison.
Kia ora, Karen. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. Alison is fresh from an event organized by our Greyland Library as part of the same but different LGBTQI Literary Festival. Alison and I thought that during this show we might use the word rainbow writing just to make it. We're nervous enough being on the air, so. Rainbow Literary Festival, held every year as part of Auckland's Pride celebrations. She was one of the stars, which is to say, she was one of the Sisters Gay motto, Move Over Brothers Grimm, who presented an after-hours story time for grown-ups and other family with the tagline, Fairy Tales Will Never Be the Same. On my invitation, I'm winking at Alison for those of you who can't, well, for everyone out there who can't see me, wink, wink, Alison. On my invitation, Alison has agreed to reprise her performance for us today, reading us a modern fable with a different twist on the happily ever after. So before you start reading, Alison, an introduction. What is this? Where did you find it? Who wrote it?
Right. So my colleagues and I at the Greyland Library found a book called Fairy Tales for Lost Children, published in 2013 by a writer called Dirye Osman. Now, he's a fascinating character. He was born in 1983 in Mogadishu, Somalia, and in 2001 he and his family moved to London. He's a short story writer, an essayist, a critic, and a visual artist. He's certainly one to watch. So the piece that I'm going to read is called Watering the Imagination.
That sounds just like us. That's exactly what we want. Let's
hear
it.
Let's go. I have spent my whole life living near the coast of Bosaso, Somalia. I don't know any other land. While the boat people, those who are hungry for new homes in places like London and Luxembourg, risk their lives on cargo ships, I stand firm on this soil and I tell stories. I tell stories to my daughters about kings and warrior queens, freedom fighters and poets. I tell these stories to remind my children and myself that Somalia is fertile with history and myth. The only seed that needs regular watering is our imagination. My eldest daughter, Suldana, is in love with another woman. She is 18 and she spends her days working at our kiosk selling milk and eggs, and at night she sneaks out and goes down to the beach to see her lover. She crawls back into bed at dawn, smelling of sea and salt and perfume. Suldana is beautiful, and she wraps this beauty around herself like a shawl of stars. When she smiles, her dimples deepen, and you can't help but be charmed. When she walks down the street, men stare and whistle and ache, but they cannot have her. Every day, marriage proposals arrive with offers of high dowries, but I wave them away. We never talk about these things like mothers and daughters should, but I respect her privacy and I allow her to live. In Somali culture, many things go unsaid. How we love, who we love, and why we love that way. I don't know why Suldana loves the way she does. I don't know why she loves who she does, but I do know that by respecting her privacy, I am letting her dream in a way that my generation was not capable of. I'm letting her reach for something neither one of us can articulate. So we take our voices and our stories to the sea. Every evening we walk towards the water and we write our hopes and dreams on scraps of paper. We wrap the paper around stones and tie it on with rubber bands. We then fling these stones that carry our hopes and dreams into the ocean. My mother and my mother's mother used to do this. To us, it's a way of expressing some of the things we cannot verbalise. It's a way of sharing our most intimate secrets without shame or fear. In doing so, we have created our own mythology and history. Sultana must take that history and forge her own future. And when she does go forth, I will honour my promise as her parent and go forth with her. We will not turn back.
Oh, that is so beautiful. I beautifully read, may I say, ooh. Allison, that was wonderful. It reminds me of Paul Bowles' writing. So I think Paul Bowles is also a favorite author of yours.
Yes.
Yeah. So Paul Bowles, who lived in for 50 years in Morocco, which is not the Horn of Africa, which is Somalia, but it is Northern Africa, and had something of the same fascination. The land where he was living shares a lot of the, what you might call, I'm thinking, the sacred and the profane of a geographical area.
The mystical.
Yeah, and he, and Paul Bowles in particular, was interested in the mysticism and the magic and the myth and the ritual. He was also a drummer. He was a musician before he was a writer. And he's got one of the scenes in one of his books, The Spy Spider's House, which really reminds me of this story, where the Arab boy Amar finds a dragonfly which has gotten wet, and he saves its life by very carefully finding it a place where he can put it where the sun will dry out its wings. And you know, in these stories, in Paul Bowles' stories of this life in his adopted country, I think he should get a lot of credit for an attempt which not all Europeans made. He was American, but I mean, you know, Europeans in the sense of non-Arabs.
The expat.
Yeah. Seems to be trying to see Amar in this story without preconceptions. Which is probably a lesson that you get also from his life, in the sense that he lived a very unconventional life. Mm-hmm. Being a gay man in a lavender marriage, hanging out with his place of abode in Tangier was an apartment where everybody came through, every literary figure from Genet to the Beats to William Burroughs to Tennessee Williams. It was right up there with the literary milieu, but at the same time, he was actually born in an Edwardian era. He was a lot older. He was this old man. They would describe him sitting on the couch smoking keef, stoned out of his mind, always observing, a very detached observer. But he was very attracted to these currents of magic. And he talked about sorcery and the unsuspecting recipients that were being cast, that spells were being cast on. And his writing is sort of like that, cast a spell, don't you think?
Yes. Yes, I do.
As the story cast a spell over me, your story that you read.
Mm. I think Paul Bowles was fairly sensitive to his surroundings, wasn't he, and to his adopted country.
Yeah, I think he really stood out in that way as compared to the people who were trying to make the country over in their image, or at least the people they hung out with in that country over in their own image. He felt he had a lot to learn from where he was. But also, sensitive?
Yes.
A very, if you look at, so in terms of his marriage, his very unconventional marriage. So Jane Bowles is also a writer. We recommend Jane too, don't we?
Yes, we do.
For people to read. But Jane had a very tragic life, died at only 50 after 16 years of terrible invalidity, both mental and physical. And Paul was this amazing, patient, loving nurse through all this time.
Which I suspect was unusual for the time.
Yeah.
A lot of those male authors weren't particularly nice to their partners.
No,
particularly the female ones.
Yeah. No, so, you're absolutely right. Yeah, yes. I mean, so much has come out about the bees that you cringe, when you look back sometimes at this, and the lack of acknowledgement of the female writers in the Beats movement. And did I say Beats movement or Beat movements? No, I said Beats movement. they were very different. Jane was an entertainer. Paul was a detached observer. But they were, really... attuned to this adventure of life. Mm. But it was sad because Jane was self-destructive, and that's the thing. They started out on a big adventure, and he made it through, and she didn't make it through. Mm. But anyway, so that was just my little thought. But I don't want to hold up. We couldn't happily go on for half an hour talking about Paul Bowles. But I wanted to ask you. So Paul Bowles was one of my, and I think also yours, seminal authors. Do you have some seminal works also that you could tell us about that fit in with our rainbow writing theme?
Yeah, well, I really do think that a series of books that influenced me and my own journey, the series by Armistead Maupin called Tales of the City. And so this was a series of 9 novels set in San Francisco during the 1970s and 80s. And it was serialized, wasn't it?
In the Chronicles, San Francisco Chronicle, yeah. So you had to write a chapter a day or a chapter a week, yeah.
And I think people used to absolutely hang out to... They couldn't wait to
for
get
the next installation. Yeah.
Installment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I said installation. Yes. So, sorry.
But, and I just loved these books. They explore that concept of otherness and what it's like to feel outside the perhaps what is...
The norm.
Norm.
Yeah,
yes,
conformity.
I hesitated to say normal. I was trying to think of another
So the norm is actually the perfect representation of what we mean when we say... It means normal, but it takes on its own significance, doesn't it? It's sort of like a meme, the norm.
Yeah, that's right. And so these books chronicled the lives and loves of a really diverse group of misfits, I guess you'd call them, in San Francisco. They were people who didn't fit in, but they were making lives for themselves, and they were making it work. The books are really funny. They're sad, there's tragedy, there's triumph. But overall, I think you come out of the experience with a real feeling of hope. And that is what the series gave me as a younger person, this sense of hope that it will be okay. I can make this work.
I think it also, doesn't it, lets you feel that you're a part of them. You found a family as well in this group of people, isn't
it?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, and I must admit it's a series that I read again. I do go back to it, and it always feels like I'm getting into my favourite armchair with my favourite cardigan.
And you can tell the value of it, because even if occasionally some slang comes through, which is quite out of date, it doesn't bother you. It's not, you don't cringe, isn't it?
That's right. In fact, some of the slang expressions, they're delightfully dated, really. But you don't get that cringe factor. I was reading yesterday, and one of the characters was saying, "I'm in such a cosmic funk." And I thought, oh, I love that expression. I think I'm going to adopt it.
Bring it back. We need to bring it back. Yeah, well, it's so funny when I said, so then you can talk about some of your seminal authors, that I just happened, this is totally, I want everyone out there to know, this was not prearranged. I happen to have been reading, Armistead Maupin has just come out with a memoir, actually came out last year with a memoir, and it's called Logical Family, which the title of which refers exactly to this thing that you're talking about. So Armistead Maupin grew up in a very bigoted, straight-laced, old-fashioned family let's put it this way, a southern family in the United States, North Carolina. So we don't have to say old-fashioned. It's enough to say, from North Carolina, and bigoted. And he is the inventor of this term, which is the name of his memoir, Logical Family, which was a term he invented to say when your biological family can't respond, or you can't find a response, you don't feel you fit in with it, you are able to go forth into the world and create your own family, and it's called the logical family. And it's exactly what the people in that book, who are based on people that he knew when he went to San Francisco, that's what they did.
Yeah.
He has a really good moment where he talks about going out to San Francisco when he leaves North Carolina and decides to go to San Francisco. And he goes to say goodbye to this very old woman who he lives upstairs from. And she is very, very old. And she gets a little mixed up for a moment and tells him that before he goes, he should stop up and say hello to that nice boy who lives upstairs from her, who is him. But he says it was actually a really appropriate send-off, because in going to San Francisco, that's what he was doing. He was meeting up with all the parts of himself that he had not been able to express until then. So he was actually meeting himself.
Yes, meeting and finding himself.
And speaking of finding, you've got another find there that you've brought in for us that you grabbed from the library, I believe.
Yes, I've brought in another book, also set in San Francisco in the 1980s, and it's called The Golden Gate, and it's by fabulous author called Vikram Seth, published in 1986. I have to admit here that I've got a huge literary crush on Vikram Seth. I've heard him interviewed on the radio numerous times, and he's just divine. So Golden Gate is also about a group of friends in San Francisco in the 80s. It's about their lives, their loves, their losses. It's also, I guess, very similar in that it's young people trying to find where they fit.
But there was a whole odyssey of people moving to San Francisco in those years for that very reason. I mean, you get these hubs of activity and new things, and San Francisco is very much the one in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it really...
New York and San Francisco.
Yeah, it really did seem to be. So it really touches a lot on loneliness. But it is a positive... a really positive book. Now, something fascinating about it is that it's actually written entirely in verse, in iambic tetrameter, which is a bit like a musical... has a musical beat. Yes, four beats to a bar. And even his table of contents is in verse, and his acknowledgement page. So it's really delightful.
So you had an example you were giving me as we were coming over here today of iambic tetrameter.
Yes, because people probably think,
very famous.
What is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the Christopher Marlowe poem that has one of its lines says, "Come live with me and be my love."
Yeah, one of its lines is opening line, isn't it?
Oh, is it? Yeah. Yes, of course, it is. Yes.
The passionate shepherd to his love. Come live with me and be my love.
Yeah, so that's the musical sort of four beats.
Yeah, so don't let that scare you, because as you can see, that actually works really well for telling a story.
It really does, yes. And it's not the sort of novel if someone had told me about it, I'd think, oh, I don't know that I could handle it. But I just adore it.
Yeah, I mean, it was exactly the same way. When I hear a novel written in verse, my first reaction is to cringe. But you talked me out of it when you showed me. Yeah,
yeah, it's really delightful. And it just has such a sense of hope. It really is great. One of the aspects of it that perhaps dates it, but in a lovely way as well, similar to Tales of the City, is the use of the personal ads in newspapers. So when these people are trying to find love or companionship, whatever, they'd put an ad in the paper.
The pre-Tinder days.
Yes, yes. So, and these days we use an app. But the ads in Golden Gate, of course, are written in verse as well. So they're delightful.
That's fantastic. You don't have one there, do you? An example?
Oh, I probably do, but I'm not sure that I might have to...
Maybe for the next show.
Maybe for the next show. I'll just tempt the listeners.
Yeah, I can remember. I'm old enough to remember the personal ads, and they would, depending on what publication they were in, so like the New York Review of Books had one kind of personal ad.
Yeah,
and the Advocate would have another kind of ad,
yes,
and so on. Yeah,
because I think the Times Literary Supplement still has them, I think.
Yeah, no, I think, I'm sure the New York Review of Books does as well, but they've had to adapt into a more niche thing where it's sort of like, come to the literary dinner and meet your soulmate.
Yes.
I don't think you find quite the variety that you once did when print media was the only place to place your ad.
That's right. Now, and I think Vikram Seth is a genius, actually. He's so clever. But he manages to show his great intellect without being obnoxious. And I think that's quite a skill, because I think there are writers... perhaps more recently, who I've read and I thought, oh, they're just trying to show me how bright they are.
Showing off.
Showing off, yes.
Yeah, I can think of a few.
I can too.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, there are others that have that incredible skill. So I would put in, what's the name of the man who wrote The Swimming Pool Library? Hollinghurst.
Yes.
Like, I think he's got an incredible prose style. He's just so able to use that out of the ordinary expression without it seeming like he's showing off. Whereas for me, Michael Cunningham sometimes borders on that a bit. But so Vikram Seth lives, where does he live now?
He divides his time between Delhi in India and London.
Oh, right.
I believe. But he did live for some time in San Francisco.
Because
he was doing a PhD at Stanford.
Yeah.
I think.
I don't remember seeing him mentioned in this. Brings up a person that I would like to put in a quick word for. In a way, that one of the fathers, I think we could say. I'm not sure if fathers goes with the term gay fiction. Maybe we could call him the frisky old goat. He prefers to refer to himself. Edmund White. So also present in San Francisco in those years, but most of his time spent in New York and then in Paris. And I am just a huge Edmund White fan. Are you?
Yes, I am.
I actually got to meet Edmund White. He came to Auckland for one of the Auckland Writers Festivals, and I got to accompany a librarian who was going there to interview him. And he was... he was definitely frisky, but also plumper and kinder than I expected. He always talks about being fat, but I didn't realize he actually really is fat. But it goes along with this huge personality, both himself and also his place in history, and especially in gay history. Because, you know, when Armistead Maupin says, well, you don't know this because you haven't read Logical Family yet, but he's got this wonderful line where he says, he's talking about losing his virginity, which he lost late to his great distress. And it opens the chapter, and he says, in the summer of 1969, in that month between the Stonewall Rebellion and the moon landing, I finally lost my virginity. And I was reading, and I went, 50 years ago. Like, I had actually not thought about that. Both of those incredible events happened 50 years ago. And Edmund White was, you know, the Stonewall Rebellion was a huge, it was something that he picked up and ran with in this attempt to move gay writing beyond that sort of elusive, erudite kind of admit and not admit thing into something that was a rebellion. It was a way of saying we can explore our identities in fiction and we can be honest.
Yes, and that we don't have to sort of hide it below layers of puzzle.
And it's sometimes even like Tennessee Williams, I don't know if this is true, but somebody pointed out to me, and I thought it was quite true, sounded quite true to me, that, for instance, the Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone, the aging American dowager in Rome, and her unsuccessful love affairs with gigolos, love affairs perhaps not the right word, that it's actually, he's created a woman, but he was writing about a man. Wow. But he couldn't write about a man. Edmund White... why was I telling you about Edmund White?
On Stonewall.
Oh, about Stonewall. Yes, I was just saying his historical position in the gay writing, in the movement to create a gay fiction. And I think that, the self-affirming, he describes it as wanting to have a text that was, I thought this was very appropriate for our show, self-affirming, self-respecting, and proud. So, that's what we say when we say pride. And... So what I've been talking about now is I was refreshing my memory with a wonderful book of his, which is called Arts and Letters. But the book that I went to talk to him about at the Writers' Festival was My Lives, which is awesome.
Yes.
Although everyone should probably start with Boys Own Story.
I think that's where I started.
So those are sort of our historical references. But I wanted to say, what are you reading now?
Well, I happen to be reading just a fascinating book called The Trauma Cleaner.
It's the book that I just received. I've been waiting for my copy. I just got it last night, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
Well, look, I highly recommend it. It's an Australian book published in 2017. It won the Victorian Prize for Literature, I guess, last year. And it's by an author called Sarah Krasnostein. It's a work of biography, and its subtitle is One Woman's Extraordinary Life in the Business of Death, Decay, and Disaster. So the woman, the subject of the book, is Sandra Pankhurst, and she's a remarkably outstanding and incredible woman. Quite a flawed character. But so the book tells the story of her life. She was born and raised in Melbourne in the 1950s and 60s, when things were certainly a lot less progressive than they would be today. And Sandra describes herself as having been a husband, a father, a drag queen, a sex worker, a wife, and a businesswoman. So she's had an incredibly hard life, and she's a survivor, though, and she's survived the most awful types of abuse that you possibly could. But now she's... she spends her days now caring for society's most vulnerable people, and this is via her crime scene and trauma cleaning business.
Meaning so, cleaning actually physically, in fact, on the cover, because people can't see, there's a yellow kitchen glove, isn't there,
rubber glove with a spot of blood on it.
But her cleaning is not limited to the physical cleaning.
No, and she's helping people, a lot of hoarding type situations, and she's helping people find order, I guess, amongst the chaos of their lives. But you get the feeling that she's actually working on herself at the same time. Mm. She's had such a complex life, but such a resilient
woman. I love that when you said about, you know, helping people, and you used the example of hoarders. So I think it's, from what I've read of the book, which I haven't read yet, it's in general people with mental illness that she feels drawn to, survivors of trauma or whose current mental illness is causing them trauma. And I was thinking, you know, all this incredible amount of attention that gets paid nowadays to Marie Kondo decluttering and all this kind of like first world problems of decluttering, when in our first world there are also all these people living in these terrible situations that she describes, and how much less attention is paid to them than all
exactly.
So it's such a great book to have, because the woman who wrote the book, this is what I didn't understand. I thought she was kind of one of those sassy women writers that are, you know, there's so many of these sort of memoirs, and but she's actually a law student or something. What is she? She's here, I've got the book. A law lecturer and researcher. She has a doctorate in criminal law.
Yes, so she's a fascinating character herself. And some of the criticism of the book is there's a feeling among some readers that she inserts a little bit of her own story into the book.
Good for her.
But yeah, I'm kind of thinking that too.
Yeah, it's like when people say, because I think one of the other accusations is that, what's the name of the trauma
cleaner? Sandra.
Is, you know, the unreliable narrator.
Yes.
Is it all exactly the way she remembers it? Do we care? Memory is a fluid thing, and what comes out is the inner truth. It's how you remember things as being true. That's what you learn from them. That's what you experience, and that's what you want to express and share with people. So I don't care if it's literally true, every word of it.
Yes, I agree. I felt that I just wanted to take it at face value.
Yeah.
And so many things she couldn't remember, perhaps whether it had happened in the 80s or the 90s or in Sydney or Broken Hill, where she lived for a while.
Do we care? Yeah. Details.
Did that really matter? I was more interested in her process.
Yeah. Well, the process was interesting that you used the word progressive earlier. So I think when you were talking about Armistead Maupin having hope, being someone who expressed hope, and I think Edmund White does as well, and I think what you're saying, this book, the same thing. So I hope that of our listeners out there have got some ideas of some places that they could dig into gay fiction if they haven't yet, or rainbow writing, as we're calling it. And it's time for me to say thank you, because the time is never enough. Oh. Thanks so much, Alison, for coming in.
This has been really fun.
Yes, and we'll do it again.
Hopefully.
So it's ka kite anō for us. Until next week,
haere rā.
Brought to you by Auckland Libraries. Find us online at aucklandlibraries.govt.nz and
Japan. Catch the program next Sunday at 9:35 p.m. on 104.6 FM or anytime online at planetaudio.org.nz/books and beyond. Every day, every day, every day.